From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Jamie Lee Curtis tells us about growing up the daughter of movie stars Janet Lee and Tony Curtis, and becoming an actress herself. Also today, we meet Czech emigre writer Joseph Skvoretsky. Since the early 70s, he's run a Toronto-based publishing company printing censored books by Czech writers, including Václav Havel. Now that Havel is president, Skvoretsky can reveal some of the ways manuscripts were smuggled in and out of Czechoslovakia. And book critic John Leonard reviews Dorrit and Lesbos, the new novel from writer Toby Olsen. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev today won the broad new powers he says he must have to reform his country and keep it united. The Soviet Congress of People's Deputies voted to approve a bill that would create a strong presidency, with a chief executive who can propose legislation, declare war or martial law, and veto parliamentary bills. In a challenge to those new powers, the parliament in the Soviet Republic of Estonia has scheduled a session for Thursday to consider a declaration of independence from the Soviet Union. President Gorbachev today denounced a similar declaration passed in Lithuania as illegal and invalid. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
Several Estonian members of the Congress of People's Deputies said the Republic's legislature is expected to approve a declaration like the one passed on Sunday in Lithuania. Gorbachev has harshly criticized the Lithuanian action in public, but privately today he agreed to open talks with both Lithuania and Estonia about their political status. Some Estonian deputies said the promise of talks did not satisfy them. They said Gorbachev may simply be buying time with his agreement, so they'll push ahead with their own moves to establish independence. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
The political crisis in Israel means indefinite postponement of the U.S. proposal for talks between Israelis and Palestinians in Cairo. State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said going forward requires an Israeli government capable of making a decision on the U.S. proposal. More from Barry Schwide.
There is frustration at the State Department and at the White House with an Israeli government that declined to act on the U.S. plan for negotiations and is now on the verge of collapse. A contributing factor may have been President Bush's unprecedented statement describing East Jerusalem as occupied territory and referring to Jews living there as settlers. The president at a news conference said he didn't regret making the statement. Otherwise, he declined to be drawn into a discussion, saying he didn't want to meddle in emotional Israeli politics. At the State Department, spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said no one has come forward with a better plan for negotiations than the one offered by Secretary of State James Baker. She said he wasn't giving up, but she acknowledged that until the political crisis in Israel is resolved, Israel won't be in a position to make a decision. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Communist Albania today announced that it will introduce limited political reforms. The small Balkan country, wedged between Greece and Yugoslavia, has so far resisted much of the pro-democracy movement sweeping through Eastern Europe. Albania's government news agency said today that reforms will give people a greater say in the appointment of communist officials and some choice of election candidates. Prices fell slightly on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at 2,674. This is NPR. Demonstrators in wheelchairs today confronted House leaders to demand fast passage of legislation guaranteeing civil rights protections for the disabled. House Speaker Thomas Foley and House Republican Leader Bob Michael fielded questions and some catcalls from some of the 150 or so demonstrators who shouted for passage of a rights bill within 24 hours. The focus of the protest was the Americans with Disabilities Act, which passed the Senate last year but was stalled in the House. The bill would ban discrimination based on physical or mental disability in employment, access to buildings, use of public and private transportation, and other areas. Washington, D.C. Mayor Marion Barry said today that he won't resign his office while he fights federal cocaine and perjury charges. He declined to say whether he'd run for a fourth term. Nick Clark reports from Washington.
Mayor Barry's first formal appearance since he left town for treatment for alcoholism was met with applause and cheers by loyal city workers. Admitting only to alcoholism and addiction to prescription tranquilizers, Barry said nothing of his arrest in January on a cocaine possession charge. As to whether he will continue on as mayor, Barry was adamant.
My political organization is still intact, notwithstanding some defections. I don't intend to resign as your mayor.
Barry had no announcement to make about his re-election plans, saying only that he had not yet decided to run. However, in a press release authorized by Barry, his campaign organization announced the formation of a blind and anonymous defense fund and plans for two upcoming fundraisers for the mayor. For National Public Radio, I'm Nick Clark.
At his news conference this morning in Washington, President Bush sought to put down rumors that there was tension between him and Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan. There had been speculation that the president was upset with Greenspan over the Reserve Chief's refusal to lower interest rates. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There was a time when she was known as the Queen of Scream. And after Halloween, Terror Train, and Prom Night, some people wondered if Jamie Lee Curtis would ever break out of horror films. But the comedies Trading Places and A Fish Called Wanda took care of that. Now Curtis co-stars with Richard Lewis in the TV sitcom Anything But Love. And she's starring in a new thriller called Blue Steel. Jamie Lee Curtis grew up surrounded by movie stars. Her mother is Janet Leigh, who starred in Psycho, The Manchurian Candidate, and Touch of Evil. Jamie's father, Tony Curtis, starred in Some Like It Hot, The Sweet Smell of Success, and Spartacus. Tony Curtis and Janet Leigh separated when Jamie was three. She grew up with her mother. In the new film, Blue Steel, Jamie Lee Curtis plays a rookie cop on the trail of a psychopathic serial killer, played by Ron Silver. I asked her what was new for her in this role.
Well, I hadn't done a lead in a film in a long time. It certainly is a very passive character in a very action film, which for me was a real challenge. The whole role for me was a reactionary one. You've seen the film, I assume.
Yes.
Everything happens to her. She very rarely instigates what happens to her until the end of the film when she realizes that that is her only avenue. And that's a very challenging thing to do, to try to impart a performance in a reactionary mode, to try to stay clear of any preconceived notions of what's about to happen in the film or what's about to happen in her life, mm-hmm. and just be pure in her in the reactions. It was a big challenge.
Did you have to learn how to handle a gun for this one?
Yes, I'd never fired a gun before. I'd played Annie Oakley in one of Shelley Duvall's Tall Tales, which required me in 6 days to look pretend that I knew what I was doing, which was pretty insane. I'd never fired a real gun before and wanted very much to be able to fit the requirements of the technical side of the role and needed to do that by going into, you know, a little bit of background work and also basically going to a shooting range and learning how to fire a gun. And I learned how to do that. I went in L.A. a little bit. Catherine very much wanted me not to spend a lot of time with police officers in Los Angeles and wanted me to be able to concentrate on NYPD. And I did that. I came here, hung out with a couple people, and went to a shooting range often, every day, a couple hours a day. And it became a sport after I tried to deal with the first time you have a gun in your hand, you deal very much with the moral issue of guns and the power of the weapon and how you own your own personal feelings about guns and gun control. And then after you sort of get over this catharsis and this sort of very emotional moment that I really did have, it became a sport and it just became target shooting. And then you try to, like in any sport, get competitive and you try to finesse so that you could get a better score.
Jamie Lee Curtis is my guest, and she stars in the new film Blue Steel. What's the status now of Anything But Love?
Anything But Love is on official hiatus, which every show does. After you do your initial 22 or 26 episodes, whatever your order is by the network, you then take 2-3 months and wait for the next season. We do not have an official pickup yet, but we're all expecting one at any time.
No, Richard Lewis, who plays opposite you, had a persona as a stand-up comic, and it's more or less
the same character that he plays in Anything But Love. So he's kind of like doing his own stage presence, and you were an actress and had to like find your character within the sitcom. Do you think you were both approaching it from different angles in that respect?
You know, I really think that although Richard being a stand-up and having a very definitive personality, I actually believe he's playing very much a character. And Richard never improvises on our show. That's not an opportunity that he's had. He stays all to script. These shows are never written by him. He is a creative consultant and obviously helps and gives suggestions. But these scripts are all scripted. And, you know, they've taken his energy as a performer and I think channeled it into a TV character very well.
How are you both matched up?
Oh, in the original pilot of Anything But Love that we did that did not sell, I was signed up originally, and there were two men in the show. And we, you know, auditioned many, 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 many hundreds of people. And Richard came in. He was on my list of maybe five. And I had never really seen him work. I had seen, like, 2 minutes of an act on a cable show and had seen photographs of him and had just got a feeling from him that I thought we would work very well together. And he came in and was so funny in the audition that he was, out of anyone who came in, the only person who really made me laugh and just relax with them. You know, everybody else, it was like, here we are acting together, and he just let me react with him, and it was so clear that we had something.
You've described your childhood, growing up in the Hollywood area, as growing up with royalty. How would you compare the kind of Hollywood experience with, you know, growing up with your mother, Janet Leigh, who was a Hollywood star? How did that compare to royalty?
First of all, any recollection or point that I make about my childhood, you know, is always made from a retrospective position. It's being made as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
As an adult, I look back on my childhood and imagine that when you have famous parents, particularly Hollywood celebrities who are risen above a status, because they're bigger than life on the movie screen, they were both beautifully, physically beautiful people, very talented, and the public loved them so. There is a royal sense. I remember going to Disneyland and having one of those VIP tours. You know, I never had to stand in a line. It was just that part of my life. It was when I was a child, I didn't remember this. It wasn't like as a child I thought I was a little princess. And as a child, I was a normal kid. I had a great time. My mother wasn't like walking around. I'm saying that the perception of my parents was that they were. My mother raised us in a rural area of Los Angeles, almost a countrified atmosphere, up a dirt road with a donkey outside our house. In a corral. I mean, we lived in the country. We were raised a very natural existence in California, but certainly not a glitzy, glamo one, which is not something my mother adopted as a personal lifestyle at all.
Did the studios do any publicity around your birth? And if so, I was wondering if you read the articles or saw news clips when you were older.
Well, certainly now, in retrospect, I have many of these funny old Life magazines and photo plays. You know, people have told me all my life, I remember when you were born. And it's not something that I walk around going, a lot of people know when I was born. it's hard to talk about this because I really want to impart that this is not something that I think about. It's not something that I apply to my life or my daily life ever. It is a fact that this happened. And yes, my parents were huge stars at the time, and my birth was a big deal to a lot of people.
Were there any fantasies that were made up about your family at around the time of your birth? I mean, looking back, can you separate fact from fiction? The Hollywood publicity offices were really famous for just constructing lives that would be glamorous, you know, for making things up about their stars.
I read these things, and I don't believe that one word is attributed directly to my parents.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was made up. I think every single word was made up. Or they would take the fact of that Janet and Tony were married and they had a baby and, you know, our life is blessed by our baby Kelly or, I truly believe that it was just manipulated. Which was the people nobody wanted to know about the sort of downside. You know, now it's very cool and couth for public figures to sort of come clean with their personal lives. But then I think it was just that sort of manipulation of what people wanted to hear.
What was the downside when you were young?
Well, you know, my mother has written in her autobiography, she had been married twice before she met my father. And she was so afraid that someone would uncover this early marriage and make it, you know, a tawdry tale. I'm sure there was unhappiness in my family toward the end of their marriage. I mean, they divorced 10 years, you know, they divorced 10 years after they were married, but they both remarried immediately. So you can only assume that their marriage was crumbling for many years prior to their divorce. That must have been difficult. I don't know. It's not something I've really ever spoken about. It was not a pretty thing. I'm sure it was very difficult. And if you have any personal problems or any personal traumas that go on in your life, whatever they are, and certainly should not be brought up today, but nowadays it's very common for people to come to speak of those and to talk about how they affected the person now. Then I think people didn't discuss anything. And I think it led to a lot of alcoholism and, you know, a lot of problems in people in the 50s. I mean, I think I'm talking about a generational thing, not only in Hollywood. I think it was just not the time that you talked about all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it only was personified more in Hollywood.
Actress Jamie Lee Curtis is my guest, and she's starring in a new film called Blue Steel. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Jamie Lee Curtis is my guest. I know when I was growing up, I had so many fantasies that were based on movies that I'd seen. And I'm thinking that when
you... Tell us a few. We want to know.
Never, never.
We here in America want to know.
But I'm thinking when you were growing up,
Was Tyrone Power in a pair of jodhpurs anything to do with those?
But your parents were in the movies, and unlike my parents, and all of their friends were the movie stars. So I was wondering if the movies, like, were they a part of your fantasy life, or did they just seem like what the parents do when they go to work?
No, unfortunately, one of my saddest feelings about being raised in Hollywood, if there really is something that I consciously, as an adult, look back on and think I wish I could have changed it. Because I saw and knew movies, the magic is broken for me. And I was never, as a child, like I'm sure so many people who are not from the movie industry, are enamored by films and have a really romantic, powerful relationship with going to movies. Many people talk about, particularly filmmakers and actors, talk about all their lives going to the cinema, all their lives being taken to movies and watching. And I just didn't have that. Although I was shown films, they did not impart a magical quality to me. It was more just a very sort of cutthroat, this is the movie, but da, 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 da. And I wish I had that sort of magical dream of being in the movies, that people sit back in that dark theater and think, I'll be up there someday. I didn't have that fantasy.
Since, you know, growing up in Hollywood, movies were so work-related to you, when did you decide you wanted to act yourself?
Well, again, growing up in Hollywood, you know, they were work-related in the sense that my mom and dad did them, and I would go and hang out on the set on occasion. You know, I was in school most of the time, so you don't go hang out very much. And again, I don't have any recollection of when it was I decided to do it. It just was, you know, really by chance that it happened that I'm an actress today, because tennis teacher I knew was sort of turned into a quasi-manager, and he wanted me to go up for Nancy Drew, which I didn't get, but I guess there was interest in who this little girl was. I was in college at the time and ended up in California on a month's break and did an independent study on just sort of how to break into show business. And I ended up signing a contract with Universal Studios for right at the end of that month, right before I was supposed to go back to college, and never went back.
This is Universal TV?
Well, at the time, it was Universal. Well, I mean, it was MCA Universal. They were the last studio to still have a contract system, very much like my parents. I mean, the ironic thing that, in fact, nobody's brought up very much, and I find interesting, is that both my parents were contract players when they first started acting. They were young people. My mother was discovered, literally discovered. My father was in New York. He was discovered, brought out to Hollywood. Both of them grew up on the studio system. And in fact, I was one of the last actresses in the world to be under contract. Literally 7-year, 6-month option, their option contract, where I got paid $235 a week. And they disbanded the contract system about 3 years into my contract. But I did. They farmed me out to do Halloween. They lent me out. I mean, it was a real contract system. Sharon Gless, mm-hmm. myself, Delta Burke was under contract at some point. Andrew Stevens.
Were you groomed to be a certain kind of actress by Universal? Because you know, in the contract system, you were often groomed to be a certain type for certain types of roles.
No, one of the reasons I think the contract system disbanded was at one point Universal had like a monopoly on primetime television. And so it was very convenient for them to have sort of a crop of young actors that they could still had to audition for parts, but they were paying them a fairly small amount of money and giving them experience. And the hope of the contract system always is that you're going to groom a young star, that one of these times you give this person a part, it becomes huge, you've got this person under contract for no money, and you basically have a very hot commodity, which you're not paying a lot of money to and you're making a lot of money on. The problem with the current contract system that finally disbanded was that they never took it that final step. They never had the material or the bravery to sort of give one of these contract actors the big break. They just never had the guts to go with a contract actor. They always went with like some other person from the outside. And so they really disbanded it. Whereas in my parents' generation, you know, they did, and they also, in my parents' generation, there were acting teachers afforded to these contract players. They taught you how to dress and makeup, and they groomed you in as either a, you know, the fresh country girl or the femme fatale or whatever. There was no support given to these contract actors except a paycheck every week and the knowledge that they would get a good shot at getting some episodic television. That was it. So I think another reason it disbanded is that it just wasn't, in a modern society, it's just not feasible to have that.
So what did you get? What kind of roles did you get in the 3 years that you had this contract?
Well, I did two lines on Quincy was my first job. Then I did an emergency. Then I played a biker chick on Nancy Drew. Then I did one other show there, and I can't remember what it was. And then I did the pilot for a series at Universal called Operation Petticoat, which during the shooting of the pilot, it was a 2-hour movie of the week that was a backdoor pilot is what they call it. And in the middle of shooting that 2-hour movie of the week, we got picked up as a series. So all of a sudden, I was on a series for a year, Operation Petticoat, 1978.
So Universal Studio loaned you out to do Halloween. How did you get the part of Halloween? It was your first. It was your first movie, wasn't it? Starring role in a movie, anyways.
Oh, certainly. It was an audition. Like, you know, when you're a young actor, you audition every day, and it was just another audition. I just went in and read for John Carpenter and then came back and read again and then came back and read again and got the part.
I know Halloween was considered the first in the slasher films and everything, but really you were the kind of heroine in it who was important because you weren't the passive victim. You were being stalked by the psychotic killer and you were fighting back and you won. And that was kind of a breakthrough in a lot of ways, really. Were you aware of that at the time?
I was aware that I was very glad that I was upholding the strength of women. I also was playing women with intelligence. Mm-hmm. I was playing the high school brain. I was playing what we all hope are the good virtues of young women. You know, women who are intelligent, who read, who study, who are good friends. I mean, I really believed, even though I was being slammed up against the wall by the women's groups, that I was in these what seemed to be exploitation films, I was not being exploited. I felt I was upholding very, you know, I mean, come on. I mean, in the context of real life, we're talking about a horror movie. But in it, since it was my only job and I was a young woman, I felt I was holding up the real, you know, the best that I could be as a woman in those films. I certainly was never playing the slut or the little tease or any of those that would be easily exploitable parts. I was playing the good girls, and I was very happy to have that role.
Jamie Lee Curtis is my guest, and she has a new film that she's starring in called Blue Steel. Two of the movies you're best known for, Trading Places and A Fish Called Wanda, are comedies. Did you have to learn how to get the timing for a comedy, or did that just come naturally to you?
I've been sort of ham-like a lot, and I guess I've had a dormant comedic background without really ever having the guts to say I did. I think to say that you kind of want to do comedy is a very bold statement. It almost imparts a confidence in yourself as a comedian, and I didn't have that. And so it was sort of a, you know, I needed John Landis to come and say, you know, you should audition for this movie. I also was playing fairly straight characters in both those films. If you look back at those films, you know, I am not the yuckster in there. I'm pretty much a very straight character in a funny film, and I've learned more than anything I've learned on my show, how to relax, how to work on my timing, how to redo timing if I've done it well in the, earlier in the week and then sort of lose it by the end of the week. I try to come up with techniques to help me get back to a certain timing that I liked better on a line or something. But I've certainly learned a lot more doing my show.
You're a mother now. Your daughter is two or three?
My daughter's three. Three in a bit.
What are you doing as mother to... I imagine you want to give your daughter as much of a, quote, normal upbringing as possible, because you felt that you were brought up in this, you know, like, royal...
No.
That people saw you as royalty.
Yeah, please understand
understand. Okay. I really do understand. But it's a feeling I figure you might not want to impose on your daughter.
My husband and I both are fairly private people, my husband being a very private person. And I choose to live a normal life, as really normal as I can live. And my big attempt with my daughter, besides just helping her create a real sense of herself, so that if someone does want to know her because she's my daughter particularly, that won't faze her, that she will know that she has a very unique and very individual personality, which she does just naturally on her own. She's just a spark of a child. I will never subject her to any of the publicity side of my business. That's a choice that my husband and I have made very consciously. If I'm being photographed in my home, my daughter will not be in the pictures with me. If I'm on Entertainment Tonight, she won't come scampering in the room. You won't see pictures of us on the cover of Good Housekeeping. I'm going to try very hard to keep her separate from that at all costs, so that she can make the choice when she chooses if she wants to do that. If when she is a choice-making young adult and chooses to pose in a picture with me, fine. But I want it to be her choice and not one that I impart on her.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us. Thank you.
I've enjoyed this.
Jamie Lee Curtis stars on the new film Blue Steel. She also co-stars with Richard Lewis in the ABC sitcom Anything But Love. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, a concert of jazz standards with guitarist Howard Alden and trombonist Dan Barrett. This is from their latest record.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. For the past 20 years, many banned and censored works by Czech writers have been published in Toronto by the Czech emigre writer Josef Skvoretsky. Until very recently, this entailed smuggling manuscripts out of Czechoslovakia and smuggling books back in. Coming up, Skvoretsky tells us how he kept banned books alive and what he plans on doing now that one of his writers, Václav Havel, is president. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews the new novel from Toby Olson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush ended 5 years of economic sanctions against Nicaragua today, and he called on Congress to approve $300 million in assistance to the government of incoming President Violeta Chamorro. Mr. Bush also wants $500 million in aid for the government of Panama. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The president said the damage to the economies of Nicaragua and Panama has been great. In Nicaragua, 5 years of U.S. trade sanctions and the Contra War are the main reasons. In Panama, last December's U.S. invasion and sanctions against the government of former leader Manuel Noriega are partly to blame. The president says the money for his Fund for Democracy should come from cuts in defense spending, but he conceded that many feel defense cuts should benefit domestic programs, not foreign aid.
I think they raise a good point. I mean, there's a lot of domestic problems, but we're sorting this out now, and I'm convinced that when the American people understand what we're talking about offsetting proposals in defense, in other words, not going in there and costing them more, or taking it away from some other program, that it will have strong support.
The president said his proposed investment in democracy is the right thing to do. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
President Andorra, Panama, has ended a 13-day fast, prompted by an appeal from members of the National Assembly who were concerned about his health. Having lost 17 pounds, Andorra, who appeared fit and well, said that he felt that he had made his point, a show of solidarity with the country's poor and hungry. But he also made another thinly veiled call for U.S. financial aid. David Adams has more on the story.
The 53-year-old president said that after 13 days fasting, he now knew what it was like to be poor and go without food for days on end. His decision to end the fast came shortly before President Bush made a plea to Congress to speed up its consideration of an $800 million aid package for Panama and Nicaragua. Before the fast, Andorra weighed 249 pounds, which prompted some to call his refusal to eat more of a diet. Andorra told a press conference that he will soon put back the pounds that he's lost. This brought laughter and applause from the audience, which included the president's new 22-year-old fiancée. Andorra says his fast was not directed at the U.S. Congress, but he remains critical of the failure of the United States to send $500 million humanitarian aid, which was promised by the Bush administration after the American invasion of Panama in December. The country remains on the edge of bankruptcy following the destruction of the economy in the wake of the invasion. For National Public Radio, this is David Adams in Panama City.
While much of the eastern part of the country had record-high temperatures today, a winter storm hit Colorado and Wyoming. In New York City, it reached 85 degrees, which is 38 degrees above normal. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 12 points in moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Before Václav Havel became the president of Czechoslovakia, he was best known as a dissident playwright. His books, banned in his own country, were published in Czech by the Toronto-based company 68 Publishers. The company is run by Czech emigre writer Josef Skvoretsky and his wife. For close to 20 years, they put out books by Czech emigre writers as well as dissident writers living in Czechoslovakia. The Skvoretskys left their country in 1969 after the Russian invasion. The couple settled in Canada, where Josef Skvoretsky became a professor of English at the University of Toronto and continued writing novels. His best-known books are The Cowards, The Engineer of Human Souls, The Bass Saxophone, and Dvorak in Love. He's also written a series of detective stories. I spoke to him about how he kept alive the work of silenced writers. He told me it was his wife's idea to start the publishing company.
I was against it because I was afraid that we would fail, because many people had tried this before us, and they usually publish one or two or three books and then they went bankrupt. And I was afraid that, you know, the establishment in Prague would be very glad if they could say, see these exiles, they think what sort of cultural people they are, and they fail after a book or two. But my wife persisted, so we published first my novel, The Tankor, which is a satirical novel about the communist army. So this book was a sort of bestseller, you know, measured by the standards of the emigre market. And that we made money from it, which we then reinvested into other titles, and it grew so that by now we have published 220 titles.
I don't know how free you feel to talk about this yet, but I'm wondering how the censored books or books by banned writers still living in Czechoslovakia were smuggled out to you so that you could publish them.
Well, I don't know. I think they should tell it, you know. There were ways, of course, and it worked, you know. We practically got all the manuscripts that we wanted. We always got them. So it worked, and there were various ways, you know. Some private tourists took them out sometimes, you know, courageous tourists. When we started publishing, we had several manuscripts on film. You know, people in their washrooms just filmed or photographed it page by page, then smuggled out the film. And later on, various routes developed. When, for instance, the situation improved in Poland and in Hungary, so there was a route through Poland and through Hungary. So there were many ways, but I don't think I should talk about it in great detail. That's up to the people who live there, you know, to tell you.
What about smuggling books back into Czechoslovakia so that Czechs could read their own writers?
Well, that's a similar thing, you know. Many books were simply taken by tourists because, you know, Czechoslovakia borders on West Germany, and there were probably thousands of tourists crossing the border every day, and you can't check all of them, you know. So there were many tourists who were willing to put a book into their pocket because we only publish paperbacks, small books. And then there were, of course, the proper routes, which at that time were secret, and again, I don't know whether I should, you know, disclose them. I don't know so much about them. I didn't ask, you know. I knew where to send the books, and I did it, you know, and I didn't ask because if you don't know, you can't blabber about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm wondering, too, if you think it's not time yet to reveal certain secrets. I mean, if you think it's still time to be a little bit cautious.
Well, I don't know whether it's so interesting to reveal the secrets. At one time, for instance, there existed a car, a custom-made car, which was paid for by various Czech emigre organizations with the support of some American groups. And that had a compartment built into the engine. I don't know how they did it. They isolated it from the heat. And it could hold about 50 paperbacks. And that crossed the border several times every month, you know, with the 50 books inside. So that was one way how to smuggle those books. And, of course, we had friends in various, you know, diplomatic services who were willing to take the books with them and so on.
How would the money from the books go back to the authors who'd written them?
Well, we did not pay any royalties to writers living in the West. They understood that we didn't pay any money to ourselves. You know, this was purely voluntary work. And we are not organized as a business. We are a non-profit, non-share company, you know. And the writers who lived in the West understood this. They were glad that their books were published, you know. We only paid, we sent money to dissident writers in Czechoslovakia. And we didn't have to send them too much because, you know, $100 in Prague translated into a large sum of money for which you could live probably for 3 months, you know. So we usually pay them $500 or something like that. And we send that money to them again by various ways, you know. And then in the later stages, before this the communism fell apart, we were able to deposit the money in their accounts in Prague, you know, send them through banks here. So we paid only dissident writers.
Are you convinced that you won't need to smuggle books anymore?
Well, if the situation holds as it is now, I am sure we won't need to.
I'm asking how confident you are that the situation will hold.
Well, I think that I am very confident, unless, of course, something terrible happens in the Soviet Union. Because I can speak for the other countries, but in Czechoslovakia, Of course, you know, they had a secret police force. Nobody knows how many of them there were, but certainly something like 100,000 secret policemen. And they are there, you know, they didn't disappear. But they have no chance of subverting the regime or stating a coup d'etat because they have no foreign support at the moment. But of course, should something happen in the Soviet Union, you know, should someone replace Gorbachev, who would be more like Stalin or something like that, then these people would feel encouraged and who knows what might happen. But I don't think that history can really repeat itself so identically. You know, very difficult times are ahead, obviously. But unless there is foreign intervention, I am absolutely confident that the people in Czechoslovakia and in the other formerly communist countries will manage quite well.
During all the years that you have published banned Czechoslovakian books, censored Czechoslovakian books, were there informants spying on you in Toronto?
Well, there were some very naive approaches, you know. The only people who were permitted to travel to the West were old people, you know, old age pensioners who had children living in Canada and in other Western countries. And at one time, I received 6 or 7 visits from these old people who always phoned me, and they always told me that they had some important message for me. So I said, all right, so come over. And they came, and the message was, well, Mr. Havel sends his greetings, you know. That was the important message. So obviously they were asked by the secret police that if they want to see their children, they have to do some service for them. And the service was to visit me and look around and ask me questions. But, you know, these people are usually very nice old people who simply wanted to see their parents. So I developed a technique. I always gave them whiskey to drink. And they are not so used to hard liquor. And they very soon became, you know, tipsy. And then they told me everything. And I didn't tell them nothing, you know. So that was funny. Once I had a young girl who came. She phoned me from Montreal and said whether she could come over again, that she had a very important message and so on. So she came and I gave her whiskey to drink. And she said, well, I can, you know, bring messages from you to your friends in Prague. And I said, well, I don't know whether you know the people I know. He said, oh, I know everybody. I said, well, do you know Mr. Havel? Of course I know him. You know Mr. Vaculík? Of course I know him. And then I made up 3 names which of people who didn't exist, and she knew them all. So it was quite obvious, you know. So this kind of agents they sent to me, you know, they were really very harmless.
So it was only the amateurs then who
amateurs,
were working
yeah.
you?
Well, you know, we were not important. I mean, they have agents to find out about nuclear submarines or something like that. So these are the, you know, the aristocracy of spies. But to a publishing house, they only sent amateurs.
Czech emigre novelist and publisher Joseph Skvoretsky is my guest. For about 20 years, his Toronto-based publishing company has put out banned and censored books by Czech writers. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Czech emigre novelist and publisher Joseph Skvoretsky is my guest. Now, what happens to your publishing house now?
Well, when this thing happened in Prague, which we didn't expect, nobody expected that, so we said, okay, our mission is accomplished. We can now close the publishing house. But then we had some conversations with friends in Prague over the phone and letters, and they convinced us that we should continue for at least another year or two, because the situation there is now very strained. There is, you know, it's free, you can publish, but for instance, there are terrible shortages of paper, so that many books would have to wait for another couple of years before the publishers could get enough paper to print them. So we decided that we will go on for about a couple of years. We have very good titles for next year, you know, for instance, Kundera's new novel immortality. We published all Kundera's novels in the original, in which he writes in Czech. And I have written a new novel, and several other writers who are not so known in the West, but very good writers, have given us their manuscripts, because it became a sort of prestigious thing to be published by the 68 publishers, you know, because we've been doing this for 20 years, and so people also feel sentimental about it. So we'll simply carry on for another couple of years, I think.
Well, would you like to carry on for more than that and just redefine your role a little bit?
Well, I would like to, but, you know, I am no longer a youngster, and I also want to write. And this is a very absorbing business, you know. If you do this publishing, we have no employees. It's just me and my wife. So you can imagine that we spend far too many hours just, you know, doing work, making the books. And I want to have more time for my own writing, and my wife should have much more time for her own writing, because she's a very good fiction writer, but she gave all her time to the publishing. You know, she wrote a novel called Summer in Prague, which was published in the States 20 years ago by Harper and Row. But since then, she hasn't had time. So she only wrote a few short stories, and that's all. So I think we will reduce our production anyway.
Do you think that the importance of books will diminish when books are no longer underground vehicles for forbidden ideas?
Well, that depends on how you define importance. Certainly, because books will no longer be forbidden fruit, so there will be less interest in them. People who, because while books are banned, many people read them who, under so-called normal circumstances, would not read novels. They would watch the TV or something. But I don't think that the importance of books will ever diminish or disappear, because they are very important. Good fiction is so important for every people's life, you know, for every nation's life, and that will not change. I think the only readers who will stop reading will be people who are not really interested. They only read the books because they were forbidden. So good riddance, you know. But those who really like read books and who derive something from them, they will continue reading them, I'm sure.
Are you interested in going back to Czechoslovakia?
Well, we are going there for a visit in about a month. But we won't return for good, you know. We have become Canadians, and, you know, we spent 21 years in Canada. And we feel very much at home in Toronto. And, you know, my life in Canada, that was the first time in my life when I enjoyed, you know, a liberal democracy, because prior to that, I had spent my life under various totalitarian regimes, except I was 14 when the Nazis occupied the country. So the first 14 years of my life, I lived in a liberal democracy, but I was a child, you know. But all my adult life, I lived under various dictatorships, the Nazi, the Stalinist, and so on. So my years in Canada were the happiest in my life, really. And so I'm grateful, and I have become a Canadian in this sense. And what's beautiful about North America in general, you know, is that you can become an American or a Canadian, which doesn't mean that you forget about your roots and that you renounce them. That's impossible in most European countries, because you can become a German citizen, but you cannot become a German unless you are one. But in Canada, in America, you can become not only a citizen, but you can become part of the society with all the rights and all the duties. So we don't contemplate coming back at all, but certainly we'll be visiting the country as often as we can.
One of the totalitarian regimes that you lived under in Czechoslovakia was the Third Reich. Are you concerned about the reunification of Germany?
Well, that's a difficult question. You know, when I first heard about it, I said, well, there is probably no danger, because, you know, Nazism grew out of the Great Depression. There was misery in Germany, much more misery than anywhere else, because they had lost the war. And I believe that the breeding ground for such extremist political movements is always misery, you know, poverty and so on. But now I'm becoming more concerned about it, because they really some of the things that you hear about Germany reclaiming part of Poland, you know, as you know, Poland shifted after the war. The Russians took the eastern part, and they compensated the Poles by giving them part of Germany. So if now the Germans would reclaim part of Poland, so Poland would be just a corridor, which is impossible, you know, and it would be unjust and nonsensical, because this country is now inhabited by Poles. So I am a little concerned about the development, but we must hope that wisdom will not disappear with communism. Now, you know, with freedom, wisdom should get stronger, but who knows?
When you go to visit Czechoslovakia, will that be your first time back since you left in 1969?
Yes, that will be the first time in 21 years.
What are some of the things that you're looking forward to the most?
Well, that's very hard to tell. You know, I don't have any family there anymore. So I have a few, very few close friends who are still alive there. So I'm obviously looking forward to meeting them. And then, of course, I'll be meeting my readers. And that's something that's very moving because, you know, they have just founded a fan club, you know, for myself, a Josef Skvoretsky fan club. And the people who founded it are very young people. You know, the chairman, the man who founded it, is 28 years old. That means that he was 7 when I left the country. So that's very encouraging that these young people who were little children when we left, and they still read my books, they somehow got access to them, and they are willing to start a fan club, you know. So that's very encouraging. And I'm looking forward to meeting these young readers. You know, I'll certainly will have discussions with students at university. And so I'm looking forward to these things mainly.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Writer and publisher Josef Skvoretsky. There's a new English translation of his collection of detective stories, The End of Lieutenant Borivka. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Here's Linda Wertheimer.
We'll have a series of pieces on Nicaragua, the president's plan for giving aid to that country, and the reaction to it on Capitol Hill. We'll also look at what happens to the rebel force, the Contras, and concerns in the country that the change of government may mean some changes in the way people live. There's a great concern in Nicaragua about land reform and whether that will survive the change of government. We also have a piece on pollution patrols in Bergen County in New Jersey, civilians on the lookout for illegal polluters, and also in New Jersey, also in Bergen County, a museum to garbage.
That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In 1983, Toby Olson's novel Sea View won the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. It was the story of a couple's cross-country trip from California to Cape Cod, a story about terminal illness, golf, Zen, cocaine, and American Indians. Book critic John Leonard says Olson's new novel, Dorrit and Lesbos, takes the reader on a different journey.
I was in too much of a hurry trying to read Toby Olson's new novel. It is, among other things, a missing person mystery. And I wanted some answers, and I hurled myself forward and I kept getting lost. I had to slow down and start all over again. Olson made me take my time, his time. He writes in brushstrokes and ideograms, as if he were Japanese. Indeed, Dorrit and Lesbos reminds me a lot of the ruined map, Kobo Abe's missing person mystery, in which the detective discovers that he himself is lost. Someone else is hunting him. Like Abe, too, Olson has piled on the mysteries as if they were glazes. Remove one, and the mask of another stares at you. Go deeper, and everything you thought you knew collapses down on you. It's a biological sort of novel writing, Ontology, the history of the individual organism, recapitulates phylogeny, the evolution of the species, the history of the race. If that sounds fancy, so is Olson. Jack Church, a landscape architect in Southern California, is summoned back to his boyhood home in Illinois. His Aunt Waverly needs him. His Uncle Edward, a famous painter whom nobody in the family's seen for 20 years, is dead. There are some very peculiar letters to look at, pictures to catalog, a cousin, Angela, to worry about, a strange tattoo, a symbolic insignia, that turns up in the damnedest places, an impossibly complicated sexual history to unravel, and three mysterious deaths in the neighborhood. What was Uncle Edward really doing in Greece, besides painting? And what was he really painting, besides the enigmatic Dorrit with her long red braid? Why does the paper trail stop 5 years before Edward's death is reported? And what does Sappho, the poet of lesbian love, have to do with all of this? Of course, I won't tell you. But Jack is set in motion, and his journey takes him back to California, off to Panama, and finally all the way to the Aegean to find a very different kind of landscape gardening. He travels as well to the past, where choices were made, and beneath the surface of art, which turns out to be the landscape of autobiography, and into the depths of memory, where, like the rock pool at Jack's Industrial Park in Long Beach, California, there's yet another surface. The large slabs of that dignified and centered mind, luminous before my feet, says Jack. And in places I could see through at the edges, the small dark voids of entrance into the underlayer, where nothing at all could be that certain. But the slabs wait, then the pool's surface, then the shadows resting on it, all gave a certain integrity that was unbreachable. It was something that Uncle Edward might have liked, not really too far at all from what he'd been after, the surface of the world where all beauty resides. If this sounds sort of zen, so does Olson. Except that Dorrit in Lesbos is also a meditation on systems of memory and the egomania of art, on ownership and dispossession, on sexual love and families as landscapes of denial and repression. To some extent, everybody on Lesbos in the Aegean has been kidnapped. In this remarkable novel, the surprise twist is not so much of plot as of perception. The truth about ourselves is shocking.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Toby Olson's new novel, Dorrit and Lesbos. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shura. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a jazz concert with guitarist Howard Alden and trombonist Dan Barrett. Also, we examine the publishing industry in the wake of the recent upheavals at Pantheon Books. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.